Good evening
Blog
and welcome.
Talk Radio.
I always wait for that Blog Talk Radio girl, Michelle, and she really is annoying sometimes. But hello, welcome to Family Matters. This is Jill Ajeezy, and of course, my lovely co-host in Chicago is Judge Michelle Lawrence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, everybody, and hi, Jill.
How are you?
Well, things are really, really cooking in Cook County. We're looking for an online parenting program to supplement what we already have. We have a new chief judge, Judge Grace Dickler, who's very progressive and is open to all kinds of new education, which is in alignment with things that you and I do.
Terrific.
So it's huge.
It's huge. And then we got a notice the other day from AFCC, and they, of course, for those of you who don't know what they are the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts that we were chosen to present at their conference in Chicago in June, and we're excited about that. I'm excited. Are you?
Yeah, definitely. I'm also excited that I have 6 months to prepare.
I know. Isn't that great? Because usually you've got to prepare on a dime. You know, people call you and say, come and present. And,
usually. Well, I'm going to Kentucky tomorrow.
Yeehaw.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk to the collaborative bar, and then I'm giving another talk to the judges, all of the judges in Kentucky, because it's their annual event.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be talking about a lot of the things that you and I care about and about what it means to understand all the science of the divorcing process and all the brain studies and all the damage to children studies, and that we're not doing enough and that we need to step up to the plate. So that's what I'm going to be talking about, and I don't know if they're ready for that, but that's what's coming.
Well, change is coming everywhere, and I sent you something today that I actually posted on one of my Facebook pages. I like to use that to let people know what's going on all around the country, and I got a post from actually a friend of ours in Chicago, her sister, and this post was interesting to me, that the New York County Lawyers Association is having a program on the myth of parental alienation and its effects on women. Now, this is for CLE credits, so they're teaching lawyers that there is a myth about parental alienation. All the work that we do was going to be kicked in the teeth by the New York County Lawyers Association, letting these people know that it wasn't real. And I think you and I both know, me having personal experience, you being around it constantly, that it is a very real thing.
Well, I read your email, Jill, and I thought maybe that we might call them.
I think we might.
And say, you know, there needs to be, it's such an explosive message that they're giving. And that's fair for everybody to give the message they want, but they really need to hear the other side of it.
Absolutely. You should hear both sides of everything and then formulate your own opinion. But I'm here to say, as I live and breathe, that it is a very real thing to very many people globally. And we need to make changes. And as long as we keep working toward creating more awareness and educating like you're doing in Kentucky this weekend, I think it's terrific. So without further ado, I want to tell you about a little bit about our guest tonight, because I've known Dr. Carrie Day since she was a little girl. And she was friends with my oldest daughter, and she is such, I knew when she was a little girl that she would be something, and she was something then, and she is something now.
Oh, really?
Dr. Carrie Day, welcome.
Hello, so happy to be here, Jill. And
well, Carrie,
Judge
we're glad
Lawrence.
To have you. Yeah. And you know, when you were giving speeches all over Springfield and all over the place when you were in high school, and telling everybody what you thought, I think what I thought about you when you were a little girl carried over to everybody else. And you now are at Texas Christian University, but specifically you're at the Bright Divinity School there as assistant professor of theological and social ethics and Black Church Studies. You've got a master's degree from Yale and a PhD from Vanderbilt. I don't know how life could be any better for you right now.
Well, you know, I'm really thankful for the opportunities, educational opportunities I've been given. You know, Jill, I'm also thankful for the context in Springfield, you know, in which I had a lot of wonderful people, including your family at that time, that helped to cultivate the gift. So, yeah.
Well, Carrie, you have special talents, and I think you know, there were many ways you could have gone in your life, and for you to do what you're doing now is just an incredible thing, and I'm so proud of you for being where you are today. We wanted to have you on. I saw that you were actually coming back to speak at the Mayor's Prayer Breakfast here in Springfield and contacted you and came to see you speak that morning just a couple of weeks ago, and you gave an amazingly just emotional speech, and it was great. But I wanted to have you on because we cover the topic of divorce and parental alienation on this show, and we've covered it from many, many angles: clinical, psychological, ethical, educational, legislative, judicial. I mean, every angle, except we haven't really talked about the spiritual side of divorce and parental alienation. Michelle, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I want to. I definitely do. And Carrie, you tell me, Dr. Carrie, you tell me what you think. As somebody who's on the legal side of things and on the bench, I am here to say that a big piece, a big unaddressed piece of the breakup of a family is a spiritual devastation when you believe that you haven't fulfilled your spiritual mission. And sometimes mm-hmm. people think they haven't done good enough. Had they have been better, I'm going to say Christians, but I mean slash anything, that this mm-hmm. wouldn't happen. And even though I can make rulings from the bench, I so much believe there needs to be a spiritual healing, and yet it's mm-hmm. left unaddressed all too often. My book is partially undercover, under the wire, a book about the spiritual healing of the anger and the blame and the forgiveness for the self and for your spouse. So.
Mm. And you're so right, Judge Lawrence, in what you're saying, because I think something that I keep in mind as someone who went through a divorce, actually, 3 years ago, is that divorce is not just about, you know, social or familial interruption, but divorce induces a profound experience of psychic trauma, spiritual trauma. In other words, at least for me, it was an experience of death, a social death of sorts in a number of ways. And so I think that you're right that when we talk about questions of healing, you know, so many times it's the question of, you know, in light of not just this interruption, but this profound experience of spiritual trauma that so many people go through because of the divorce, not to mention those who are being divorced, but the children, because I also was a part of a family where my parents went through a divorce, and there was a lot of trauma behind that for me as one that was extremely close to my father and no longer had my father present every day, at least, although my father was still a wonderful fixture in my life. But the question often is, how do I survive or cope with the situation, instead of really asking, how do I find hope? How do I make meaning in a way that allows me to define myself beyond my pain and beyond my trauma? So I think that you bring up a very important point when you talk about divorce being a profoundly spiritual brokenness and trauma.
Well, Jill and I went down a year ago in March. We went down to speak to 40 Pentecostal mm-hmm. ministers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that came out of it was when we asked them, do you have programs for your parishioners who are undergoing divorce, or do you turn your back on them? And they were quite candid. Remember, Jill? And
yes.
A lot of them said, yes, we do. We do turn our back on them.
Yeah.
And we said, do you want a program? Do you want to do this differently? Because, my goodness, you know how many people turn to their churches for answers? And when they don't get them and they feel a shame,
mm-hmm.
they turn from the church because it just – so a lot of them admitted very much that they had judged their people negatively.
Which is a very sad thing, and I think, Carrie, that's something that I hear all too often, and I speak to it from personal experience, that when something disrupts the family that the church knows, whether it's divorce or separation or parental alienation or any of those things, the church takes a side, and it lines up one way or the other. It isn't welcoming and open like it should be. And in my personal experience, at the time that it happened to me, at the church that I had attended for 21 years, they were having a divorce recovery class at the same time I was going through divorce for people to come into the church that didn't even go to that church. But I had been at this church for all this time, running, you know, the drama portion of it, and singing in the choir and solos and in a group, and they knew me and they knew the truth, but what they did was line up on the other side. And so many people tell me that my church failed me. I don't want, there is no God, because this wouldn't happen if these people were truly acting, and in this case, in a Christian way. So how do you think churches can be different about the way that they handle the spiritual walk for someone who is going to go through divorce, because we know it's not going away?
Absolutely. You know, Jill, you know, there's one distinction that I think probably should be made, I think is actually being made by the average person within American culture. And I know that a lot of theological scholars that have written on it, and that is this distinction between religion and spirituality. And I think this is a really, really important distinction to even answer your question on what churches can do. Because what a lot of people have become disillusioned about related to churches as not being safe spaces, as not being safe havens, is that churches are more preoccupied with religious dogma and religious doctrine, right? So then it becomes about the debates that surround divorce and whether divorce is right or wrong. And if a family is going through a divorce, then, you know, actions of judgment and pointing the finger and blaming is just so present within church houses. Whereas spirituality is really about this deep existential search for wholeness and well-being. It's the search for inner meaning and truth in light of divine love. You know, I like to think of Howard Thurman, who was a spiritual advisor, right, of Martin Luther King Jr. Uh-huh. And he talks about that spirituality is an inward journey. It's a journey into the core of one's ability to make meaning in the midst of their pain and their self-limitations by opening their hearts to the love of the Creator. And that, you know, in large part, this journey is about the journey to oneself in terms of forgiveness of oneself and others, in terms of love, and ultimately in terms of rest and peace of one's own life. And the problem is that churches don't take time enough to really facilitate an experience of this inward journey that I think Howard Thurman is getting at. Rather, it's a culture that really sponsors inauthenticity, a lack of transparency. Let's turn to the church, the leadership, the lack of accountability, some of the things that have gone on in the Catholic Church with a horrible misuse and abuse. I can say within the Black Church, the Eddie Long case, I'm sure everyone knew about, that was, what, a year or two ago, where at one point he had sexual abuse allegations with minors at that time. And here you have another preacher named Creflo O'Dollar that gets up and essentially says, well, if the pastor does wrong, you should stick beside him. So every member that left that church should go back. I mean, talk about the negligence. Talk about the abuse. This is the type of culture that so many churches are perpetuating. So how can we talk about an institution that perpetuates these sorts of abuses that in a lot of ways ends up hindering people's search for that inward journey? So what I'm saying is, before I think one can even answer the question on how churches can help, I think that there has to be a real truth-telling about the pathology of church culture around this nation.
Well, what is it?
So, you know, like I was saying, you're talking about the pathologies or what churches can do at this point.
Yeah, so what do you think? I mean, truth-telling, Carrie, when you say that, I mean, that in theory is something that should be happening in all denominations, truth-telling.
Right.
It should be a truthful, sincere, safe haven for people who are looking for something that is going to allow them to make meaning in their life. And so how do you get some of these churches, and I'll think about, because the only churches I really have basic knowledge of is an Assembly of God affiliated church and the Catholic Church where I attend now. How do you get them to move towards the sincerity and truthfulness when they are run by people with egos and people who want to further, you know, how do you get that out of them? Because they're just people too, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's such a, you know, it seems like a complicated question, but I really think that it begins in the pew. And what I mean by that is I think that it begins with parishioners and people in the congregation recognizing that they indeed have agency and they have subjectivity, and that they can hold leaders accountable. I think that for many congregations, there is a certain type of fear because, you know, we're talking about a culture that is, you know, that does not want to be accountable, that is not authentic at times, that is not transparent. And there's a certain type of fear and a certain type of silencing that pervades these types of church cultures. And I think it really is about parishioners reclaiming the sense that they can hold particular leaders accountable. And actually, that's what we saw in the Eddie Long case, in which you had a number of not just those who were alleging the abuse, of course, but you also had others that said, wait a minute, you know, based on the court proceedings and how everything has went, something is not right. I mean, you had even some writers like Roland Martin, who has a TV talk show, I believe, on CNN, African American Male, that actually eventually calls Eddie Long to account. People within the congregation that are doing and calling the particular leader to account. I think that it is about saying there is something that parishioners can do. It starts with the pew. Like you said, these leaders are just as human, but a part of this issue of accountability is so that we can begin to cultivate safe spaces and so that we can know that there's a sense in which all are accountable, including leaders.
Dr. Carey, what I know that you are affiliated with Evangelical Church. So what is the evangelicals' current position on divorce, and how would it align with yours?
Well, you know, in order to not essentialize or you kind of render monolithic the evangelical community, I think that there are, oh my goodness, there are a multiplicity of expressions and commitments within the evangelical community.
Okay.
I personally, so I'll just speak from my own social location. I personally come out of a particular Pentecostal tradition, the Church of God in Christ. And I, historically, at least, there were very strict teachings against divorce. I mean, all the way up into, you know, if a person or a man was divorced, he could not hold leadership as a pastor or as a bishop and the like. And so there was a sense in which divorce was something that gave you a, you know, symbolically a scarlet letter. It was the taboo, you know, of the community. But it seems like, you know, that particular denomination has evolved in the sense where it's not really set in stone, but there still is a social stigmatization, right? So it's not that in policy it's practiced, where you see many leaders within the Church of God in Christ who have been divorced and are embraced, but there's still a kind of social stigmatization oftentimes that is associated with divorce, depending on the situations. So I think that there is social stigmatization that people have to work through that is unfortunate.
So how would you like to see it, ideally, in the evangelical world, at least from your own point of view? What would you like to see?
You know, I think for me, I would really like to see when it comes, and I can speak from my own experience. At the time of my divorce, I was also a part of an evangelical community. And I think a couple of things that were missing from my experience, and as I've had conversation with others, and not just in the evangelical tradition, I mean in other denominations like the AME, I have a friend that went through a divorce. First is kind of resources within the community that help you to deal with the trauma, right? This goes back to my earlier conversation about trauma. And this has to do with how churches even view things like psychological or Christian counseling. There are some churches that do not promote, that's probably a whole other discussion, but that do not promote counseling services or psychological counseling. But at any rate, those, having some type of resources that enables divorced persons to work through their emotions in meaningful ways and their own spiritual experiences. And I know that there are some churches around the nation that are doing that, but I think it's about being more intentional, right? And then secondly, as you know, Jill was talking about earlier, you know, even from the pulpit, really talking about the problems of social stigmatization. When you walk in, there are the whispers. There are the rumors, right? This is part of what I heard you talking about, Jill.
Mm-hmm.
There are the rumors. There's a feeling of not being supported. There are feelings of not being respected by many who have gone through a divorce. And so I think it's that whole ethos, I guess, is what I'm getting at, the entire ethos that needs to change. But a part of the changing of the ethos, I think, comes through the leadership, and that's why I believe leadership being held accountable is so important, especially within Black churches, where the pastor a lot of times is, you know, the concentration of power is in the pastor. The pastor is seen as the conduit or the godlike figure, so to speak, through which God speaks, right? And so I think that that's why it's so important. So in terms of the details of what a program looks like, I don't know if I can give you that, but I get there's a sense in which my deepest desire is that there are more resources, and particularly there's a deconstruction of the type of social stigmatization that divorced people often go through.
Carrie, I always say, and I've told Michelle this, and that's one of the reasons why she came and we went to Decatur to speak to the 40 Assembly of God pastors, or Pentecostal pastors, and what I maintain is exactly what you just said, that a pastor or a minister, anyone, any member of the clergy has such power over that congregation. Why would they not put plans into place? You know, and some churches have services 4 days a week, three times on the weekends and six times on, and you could be there all the time. And you know what I mean. I mean, in the evangelical church or in the Pentecostal church, there's service almost any time you want to go. And so if we can get these pastors and ministers and clergy to talk about this, talk about changing divorce culture before people think about getting divorced, so that it's planted a seed that you can't use your children as weapons in battlefields. You have to be able to think of your children first if you're going to go through divorce, because as we know, it isn't going away. So we've got to plant that seed in these people's heads, and they respect this clergy. They respect what they're saying. They come there for a reason, to be fed by the pastor. And if he tells them, you know, look, we need to think about our children, they're going to do it.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, as just another something that came to my mind as you were talking, you know, oftentimes why aren't pastors visionary enough? Part of the comment that I heard you talking about, why aren't they visionary enough to put these programs
right
into place? And, you know, something to note is the way in which a kind of capitalist, consumerist culture has begun to pervade how churches even operate, right? Their theology all the way down to their practices. So that part of the question on perhaps why many of the pastors, men and women that are not taking this step, has a lot to do with the vested interest they have within the community. So, for example, if you have persons that, quote-unquote, tie to your ministry that are more wealthy, more influential, are setting the agenda, and don't want certain things to happen, that this profoundly affects then how the pastor practices within that particular ministry. So I at least wanted to note that there is a sense in which clergy battle and deal with a kind of capitalist, consumerist culture. They deal with parishioners, many that support, financially support the ministry, that are dictating a lot of times the ways in which the ministry should go. And so I think that it's in part this type of vested interest, alongside a number of others that,
who,
you know.
Who is it that dictates how it goes all too often?
Yes.
Who does that?
And that is, and this is just one aspect. I think there are multiple groups that can do that within any congregational setting. But I was hitting on those that tend to be huge financial givers.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
That oftentimes are very, maybe perhaps dogmatic. I'm thinking in my own local setting growing up, that are often very dogmatic in their views of particular issues. And so one of the things that they do in terms of a trade-off is, I'll tithe or I'll give money to this ministry insofar as this particular agenda is followed. And so it creates certain sorts of tensions for clergy people. That they have to live into. And, you know, so this, I think this is also a problem as well, right?
Well, I think, and it too, it parallels what's happened to the legal system, you know, the cottage industry that's been created in the legal system by lawyers and court-appointed advocates and GALs. But church has become business, and church is big business. And I think in so many cases, some of the clergy have moved away from the fact that they need to be more spiritual and become, you know, more financially focused.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. Yeah.
There's some missing. I like to get really, really practical. I don't know if it's possible, but I'd like to know, is there, you know, Jill and I always, we had a dream and we haven't put it in actualization yet. Maybe you could be a part of it, to have an interfaith symposium so that we could get everybody from all different faiths in some kind of alignment with the realities of what the world is today and what it's going to be in the future. It's okay to rely on past experiences and past doctrine if past doctrine serves you, but not with the rapid change of what life is today. So, you know, we always wanted to be able, and I believe we still will, be able to get everybody to weigh in for what it has to be and what the healing has to be like. I gave a talk to a Catholic church in Chicago, and I learned a lot. And I, that weekend, I studied the papal canons, and, you know, to try and figure out whether it was a venial sin or what kind of a sin it was and what to do. And they have annulments, which I've come to believe. If you believe the annulment's going to help you, get the annulment. For goodness sake, if you think you've sinned and you can help yourself, get it. But practically speaking, what is the archaic agenda? Does the church believe that you can't believe in family and disintegration of the family at the same time? Is that a complete anathema, even though it's real? We need to believe in the family always, but at the same time, we need to believe in the other thing too, the paradox.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is pointing to the paradox, and I think it's complex. I don't know if it can be resolved. I don't know. I think that part of what you're talking about in terms of addressing it is right on point. And again, I know you're probably not making this assumption and the language you're using about the church, because I recognize that there are many churches around this nation that are trying to deal creatively with that tension. So
that's
I do
true.
Want to say that.
That's
they're
true.
Creatively dealing with that tension. But there still is, in a sense, is that paradox. And I guess for me, you know, you talked about really making this practical right now and concrete, is to offer greater visibility. Maybe perhaps part of the program that needs to be followed is creating greater visibility, creating opportunities that make those who are already doing these type of work more audible, right? So if, you know, I'm trying to think of in San Francisco, Bishop Yvette Flunder, City of Refuge, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to think of an organization. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank right now, but is an organization that is opening, welcoming, and affirming across race, across class, across religion, across sexuality, that is really doing the work. What I often lament over is that this particular model of doing spirituality and addressing the existential issues that people have, such as divorce, is that she's not rendered visible. Instead, it seems like the media, you know, renders visible other voices like Glenn Beck or other voices like John Hagee, to where it seems there is a drowning out or there is a silencing of those that are beginning to do the work but need more visibility, need for people to know they're there. And I just really believe that when people actually know the work that they're doing, if they're a truth seeker, in a lot of ways they will be drawn to that.
Wow,
so
great
answer. So I'm just wondering if part of the practical aspect is really building on these pockets and glimpses of what people are doing around the nation, really trying to create a program that gathers and makes visible what's going on.
Well, and a more targeted to the organizing principle of our show, which is parental alienation and visitation interference. And I know that you have an interest in that particular topic, coming from your perspective, and what is your interest in that topic?
Well, you know, I had a conversation with Jill, and I want to make sure I'm talking to Judge Lawrence right now, right?
Right, right. Are we starting to sound alike?
Okay,
oh, my
are,
gosh. I know we're not starting to look
like. We're
going
to start to look
redhead.
Like our dogs and sound like just, oh, my gosh.
That's what they say. But I was talking to Jill initially. We had a conversation, and part of my work in particular, and a manuscript that I just finished, revolves around issues of poverty in relationship to African-American women and children. And, of course, kind of even though I don't address it explicitly in my text, kind of tangentially or implicitly, there is that discussion of African-American men in relationship to children, right? And so, of course, Jill and I got into this conversation about African-American communities, parental alienation, and really the complexities oftentimes that surround African-American men, fatherhood, African-American fatherhood, rather, in relationship to children. And so for me, it's entering this conversation with a real clear investment and commitment to talking about the various dimensions of Black fatherhood, and oftentimes how they are unable. I mean, this is, I think, part of the thing that is unsettling for me as well as others is this kind of unsettling myth of African-American fathers that are not in the home, so that the African-American father becomes so essentialized and almost becomes symbolic of fatherlessness, as if it really doesn't celebrate the many African-American fathers who are participating in the lives of their children. Although, there, like I said, there are complexities, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that. I don't want to preempt that conversation, but that there are complexities, but there's also the celebration that there are African-American fathers that are doing it right. And, you know, but what happens in a society where the African-American male is typified by a sense of not being in the home? And so I think that that often becomes a really lamentable aspect within the African-American community in the ways that Black men are caricatured and typified, or stereotyped, maybe I should say.
Well, I do, you know, about four or five times a month I do the paternity call, mm-hmm. which is for all the people who are trying to get child support. And I don't think people realize how many fathers are there trying to get visitation.
Hmm.
But the hostility is so amped up, because there never was a marriage to kind of sew together a certain kind of bonding.
Mm-hmm.
So if the dad can't or won't pay, the mom's not seeing any intrinsic value.
Right,
and man, I am telling you, Dr. Carey, you want to rip your heart out when you mm-hmm. see some of these guys coming, you know, without lawyers who can't afford, and let's say they're out of work, like so much of the people in the, right now because of the economy. So mm-hmm. I'm not making an inference that they're not wanting to. It just is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And so I say to them, so can you paint? Yeah, I can paint. Do you need your house painted? Yeah. Well, let him. Do you need child care while you're at work? Let him do all that. And I'm telling you, all too often, they just, like, want to do it. Anything to be around their kids. But when they can't put money on the table, they're the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And they have
mm-hmm.
so much more to offer. I'm just giving you one set of circumstances.
Wow.
They stand in front of me with tears in their eyes. Just want to see their children. And and a lot of times the moms are justifiably pissed off.
Wow.
Well,
yeah.
I think we have to point out too, Michelle, that and Carrie, that it's a really different dynamic with minority children in most cases than it is with the kids that the target kids that I deal with in the families that I talk to that are middle upper class families who get thrown into the adversarial court system and they're kept there because they have money to pay, and that court system wants that money, and as long as there's money there to be taken from the wife or the husband, they will continue to churn it up and use the children as pawns in that whole game to drain this couple dry. But in a minority a setting or a low income family, they're in and they're out because they don't have the money to keep them there. And that's very sad to say. I mean, maybe it's good in a way, I guess. But Carrie, we talked about, I can count on one hand the number of African-American children that I know that are alienated, that I know of that are alienated, as well as Hispanic children.
Identified, Jill. I think it's just not got a word for it. But I can tell you, I see it with the pissed off moms. And I'm not saying I even blame them, but if they have no use for the guy, you can bet it bleeds down into the children.
So,
they're
Carrie,
just
how
not
do
identifying
you...
it because there's no lawyers to come to court,
right?
Too often,
so they just kind of fall through the cracks.
Yeah.
Carrie, how do you identify? I mean, how do you think these children? How can their lives be different? I mean, if they're fatherless, essentially, even if these fathers are wanting to get to them, to see them. We talked about many of these kids, you know, commit crimes at 16 and they're serial offenders and then they create a generational effect of being in prison, in and out of prison. So how do you break that cycle?
Absolutely. Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Yeah, and just kind of really quickly, I like to address this at two levels. I think first at I like to call the institutional / legal level, and then I think also secondly, there are actually a number of programs out right now actually headed up by African-American men that are seeking to foreground not really new, but alternative models of fatherhood in which you have men from the community, uncles, cousins, brothers, friends, that are attempting to go into the home or go into churches where so many young black children are to father them, to offer mentoring and parental guidance and all these other things that every child needs. So I think that those are happening. I think that those sorts of programs need more funding, and I think, again, that there needs to be more cooperation within those programs in terms of more men being a part of them. But there's one thing that I want to address in terms of how do we break the cycle for our children. And I brought this up to Jill, and I think it's so worth noting that part of the issue with young African-American men, because if you look demographically at, 40 to 50% of African-American children are in single parent homes by young women. These young women are between the ages of like 18 to 25. These are young teenagers to young women, right? Mm-hmm. Demographically at least. And that part of that history revolves around the ways in which the penal system has disproportionately punished African American young, that is 16 or 17, African American young men, and by the way, I should say nonviolent offenders, who, for reasons of you know, sometimes not having adequate resources within their community, due to poverty, because if there's one thing that we know, even globally, is that poverty affects human personality, that when you have people, especially young people, situated in a situation where they have limited resources, they turn to other alternative resources to do what they need to do, because as one young man said, that is actually rehabilitated and helps other nonviolent offenders. He says, you know, when I was young, when I turned to my mother and I saw my mother hungry, it became clear to me that the bottom line is I was going to feed my mother. And so what does it mean to talk about the ways in which society needs to actually care more adequately for its children in terms of resources? And that many of these young women, young men, when they're 16 or 17, they have their first infraction. They actually go into the penal system. They're incarcerated. Many of them come out, they're disenfranchised in terms of the vote, in terms of housing, in terms of employment, and really employment, that goes across racial categories, in terms of employment, so that many of them are pushed right back, unfortunately, into a type of underground economy. So what does it mean to talk about truly reintegrating, and again, this is nonviolent offenders, of which disproportionately it's African-American men and Latino and Hispanic men. And there's a whole history there. From the 1980s in terms of with the war on drugs, with Reagan and then with Clinton, where there was a huge crackdown in cocaine users, but statistically in studies, during that same time, there was an equal amount of those that were using powder cocaine that did not meet the type of punishment that those that were using cocaine at that time, that were dealing cocaine. And what they found is that those that were dealing cocaine, they tended to be urban, poor, minority young men, and those that were dealing with powder cocaine tended to be middle to upper class white males. Mm-hmm. There's been a 200% increase from 1980 to 1996 in incarceration rates in this country, directly related to the privatizations of prison, directly related to profit. So to me, it's it is a critique and a restructuring of this entire, what I call, monster system that I feel has not adequately dealt with the real inequities that young African American, again, I'll say nonviolent offenders who go in at 16 or 17 for these first infractions, come out and are so disenfranchised, the integration back into society is further impeded. And I think this is a major problem. And thank you for letting me tell that history.
Well,
to me, that was so important.
It's crucial, and it's vitally important. But I want to take it down to the more to the micro level than the macro global problem, just for a minute, so that maybe you can help me understand what's really going on in the minds of the fathers who are marginalized because they can't contribute, because what I do really makes a difference. And for every child whose dad can get involved, it could save a child. So what two questions, Dr. Carey. One of them is the dads that don't show up, what's going on in their mind, and what is the current view on the devotion to fathering? What's the vibe about that?
Absolutely.
So you should ask me first that, and then tell me what goes through the mind of, and you maybe don't know this, because I sure haven't figured it out, no matter who the father is who doesn't show up.
You know, and I can only really proceed anecdotally of those that I've come in contact with, that I've actually had.
Just your opinion. I'm not saying
with.
This
yeah.
is...
Yeah, right, yeah, statistically or anything. You know, I think what often, you know, I'm just thinking about some of the friends I grew up with, even some of my cousins, African-American men, who have gone through cycles of imprisonment. And from some of my conversations with them on an anecdotal level, what I've noticed is what goes through their mind a lot of times is the real press and pull, say when one has had an infraction and one comes out, one cannot find, cannot establish the conditions that make for good employment. Like, for example, the young man comes out, he may move back into the move back with his significant other, maybe who he has children by, with his mother or brother or something like that. But the real stress and strain, my point is, the real stress and strain among these young men of not being able to provide, that goes back to what I was saying a bit earlier, not being able to provide in the way that they want to because of all of the social stigmas that are associated with those that have been incarcerated. And I think this is a black thing, it's a white thing, it really is those that have been incarcerated before, but especially a black thing when you're poor on top of that. And the certain types of stereotypes that come with the African-American male from the inner city. So I think it's that real burden, that real pressure, and sometimes for them feelings of needing to do whatever is needed in order to provide whatever they can for their children. And so I think primarily through my conversations with some of these young men is the real stress and strain that I'm not in any way encouraging the behavior, right, that ends up transpiring. No. But this feeling of not being able, you know, I've served my time, can I be reintegrated to society in some type of meaningful way where I'm giving a chance? And the feelings of not being given a chance, societally speaking, that complicates, that really complicates the caring for their children.
And what about, and how would you address Part B? What kind of detachment takes place when a father, when they no longer, you know, too often, and it has nothing to do with just African American. Just asking your opinion, because you see it in absolutely every culture. When the father detaches and doesn't, you know, I've said to them, I said, well, who do you think is supporting your children? Well, she is. Well, how do you know? Well, she must be. Well, do you know if they have a coat? How do you know that they aren't cold in the winter? Do you know that?
Right.
And something happens, and it's not because these are bad people. I don't buy that. But some kind of cauterization and shutdown happens.
No, I think
and
you're right.
It is the bane of my existence as a judge to figure out how to reach somebody when that happens.
Yeah, and I wonder, and you know, I don't know, but we can talk together with this. I wonder if it might have something to do with, you know, and again, I certainly could not climb into the mind of a man, nevertheless a man who does that, because I have such a great father. So to me, it's unfathomable to even, you know. But one of the things I do wonder generally is when people step away from these type of incredibly important responsibilities in some way has to do with the tremendous dread and fear and hopelessness and nihilism that they're experiencing, the sense of, really, to them, life doesn't have a whole lot of meaning, so the life that I do have, I'm going to live in this certain way, maybe if it's with pleasure or the way I want to, because, you know, because if I try to do right, it still won't be effective in the long run. I wonder if it has to do with the sense of hopelessness and fear and dread. And I mean, that can be related to a whole lot of issues. It's such a hard question.
Hopelessness,
it seems like
maybe that's the word.
I think that's a great word, hopelessness. I mean, because you have to think these guys are coming probably out of a childhood where they didn't have a father, you know, and it's just, it's hopeless to assume that they're going to be able to take over where they've never had a role model or anything at all to show them how to be a father. So it's easier to walk away in hopelessness than to stay and maybe fail at trying to be a good father.
I know. I think that is right on point. And you know, I think that many people, many young men that do that, I think it's so much, as you're right, has to do with their childhood, and may even have to do with their current conditions that cause them to, you know, end up in a place of really hopelessness and a lack of meaning, to where they feel, you know, their children are better off without them in their lives. And so I think you're really on point. And I guess part of the question is, you know, how how do we begin to talk about, as communities, changing that? And I guess I'm suggesting, I think there is something on the part of you know, there's always a sense of personal agency, right, where
mm-hmm.
we have to do certain things to get certain results. But I'm also suggesting that there are so many societal conditions at play that I think impede people that are already living with very limited resources, already living with a sense of fear on a daily basis, a sense of hopelessness because of their material conditions, that it exacerbates or intensifies. You know, so to me, I think it's both structural, but it's also personal. And I think both of those have to be addressed in even beginning to address the cycle of the absence, so to speak, of black fathers connected to incarceration, connected to, you know, portrayals of black men in the media, connected to a whole host of things.
Michelle, let me just follow up with this just quickly. If you, Carrie, could say to judges, and unfortunately there are very few judges across the country that are like Michelle, and if
yes.
you know, if we had more like her, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation or a conversation about parental alienation at all, or any of this. But what would you like for judges to know about fathering and keeping them involved in their children's lives? What would you say to them, you know, both on a clinical level and a spiritual level and a social level? How would you respond to that question?
Good question.
Yeah. I think I would ask judges to do one thing, just being very frank and honest.
Please.
And that is, you know, I don't know necessarily if this happens or doesn't happen, but based on part of what I was talking about related to the legal system, I think that there is a problem in this happening or absence. And that is really beginning to humanize these folks and to begin to really listen to their narratives and their stories, because I think that, you know, I could sit here, right, and I could talk about the issue of black fathers and what they need to do and how they're thinking, et cetera, but the reality is it's not really until one humanizes those fathers themselves and asks them within their humanity about their narratives, about their stories, I think can judges, or for that matter, any of us, get a little closer to understanding and then acting more compassionately in relationship to black fathers, to these men that are often locked in the penal system and therefore experience a parental alienation. I think it has so much to do with humanizing these folk and really hearing and seeing what's going on in their lives. And again, the complex part of it is not to dismiss some of the aspects that are very real, as Judge Lawrence said just a while back, that these mothers come in and they're angry and it's reasonable.
Exactly.
It's reasonable. It's not to dismiss that. But what does it mean to humanize, you know, to really give a human face to these men and to really understand? Because I think only compassion can only be present when people are really understood and when they're rendered human instead of objects to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that would be my, I don't think really it can, anything else can happen really until that happens. And I think that's just not for judges. I think that's for society, educators, you know, administrators within schools, people within even the African-American community. Because trust me, the feeling of some of the stereotypes and all these other things I talked about is also, I mean, these typifications are carried within black communities, just not, you know, as well as within broad society.
Well, I don't know what organization, but if I ruled the world, and I'm talking about, because when I was in law school, I worked on the prison project. And that was for 2 years, going down to Dwight and Mantino and just working with the prisoners. And if I had the money and I ruled the world, I would have programs on videos for the inmates on why their children need them, even if they're incarcerated. What letters, what what kind of life lessons they could give. There's so much that they could do if we could break through their understanding of how crucial they are, even if they're feeling no self-esteem because they're in prison. It doesn't matter. And I don't think it would be very expensive to make these kind of films throughout the prisons, because there are, I have case after case where women come in, it's mainly women, and, you know, the dad's in prison. But that doesn't mean that dad can't be a dad. It really
doesn't.
That's
right, yeah. Yeah.
It just needs to be redefined. And Dr. Carey, maybe, yet another project for you.
A good project for her.
But I bet it'd get funded. I bet it would be a big deal. I bet you could do it.
I had an interesting call the other day from a young lady who was stationed at Annapolis, Maryland, and she had been in the military for quite some time. And she called to find out how to get some help for her case. She had lost her children who were in Florida. They had been taken from her by her ex-husband. Mm. And the judge in this case wrote an order that said, military life is no place for children. As long as she is in the military, she will not see her children. And, of course, I referred her to Mike Bone, Michelle, Dr. Bone, he's working, I think, on her case. But it's, you know, it just makes me think. She said to me that she could bring 10 other women that this had happened to in the military. So there's always, you know, some problem with groups of people that you know, in this case, it happens to men too, I'm sure, but in this case, there is someone telling this woman that this particular area that she serves in and work line of work that she does is not acceptable for children. And I just thought that was the most amazing story.
Wow, that really is.
So actually, if you want to talk further about this film, I have lots of ideas.
Yeah, no, I would be very interested
because
in having that discussion. Because
guess what? Hey, how about called captive audience? How about a teachable moment? You know, what else is there to do? I mean, you have people coming out of jail with tremendous abs. You know, sit-ups are unbelievable. They're like cut, buffed to the max. Well, we can have them buffed to the max as a dad.
Well, I have Ruthie who wants to come on and talk to us a second. Actually, Dr. Carey, Ruthie is the lady who owns the syndicated news, and so she's going to come on for a second and talk to us. Hi, Ruthie.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Hi, Ruthie.
Hello, Judge Michelle. Hello,
so
Dr. Carey.
What an honor to have you come on the show.
Thank you. I wanted to let you know that the value of the work that you do that the public hears has been heard at hospitals and schools and now museums of all places. And they are bringing on people that want to join you because we're one of the few places where people can still hear classical music, not have to listen to a lot of loud music with vulgar lyrics, and look at scantily clad people and really get an education on families and law and all sorts of things that you teach on your show. And because of it, Jeffrey Clarfield, Director of Research and Development at the Alan Lomax Archive, the Association of Cultural Equity in New York City, has joined syndicatednews.net.
That's terrific.
Wow. Terrific. Congratulations.
Wow, that's great. That is great.
We are just growing
and
growing.
And an hour ago, Ernesto Arce, who is also the news producer for KPFK in Los Angeles, he's also the Southern California bureau chief for the Pacifica Evening News, came to us to make his evening statement on the state of affairs with the Occupy Wall Street and things of that nature. He brought it here.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Because apparently the Institute for Accuracy stated that at syndicatednews.net, they get it right.
And we do. And we, Ruth, yeah, I'm gonna stop with the announcements there so we can just say our goodbyes to Dr. Carrie and tell her how thankful we are. And I know I am just so grateful to her for being a friend and being just such a successful young woman. And Carrie, we want to talk to you more. So Judge Michelle and I will be in touch, and I appreciate you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you
so
much,
Hugh. Thank you so much,
Judge Lawrence.
Your wisdom and your time and your energy.
Absolutely. Thank you for being the judge that you are. We need more people like you in the judicial system. Thank you.
Oh, goodness. Thanks for saying that. Bye, everybody.
Carrie, we'll talk to you soon. Stay in touch.
Okay. Thanks so much. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You there?